Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is an encore edition of Soundcheck.
God, show me the way because the devil's trying to break me down. Know what the Midwest is, young and restless, restless, might snatch your necklace, and next these, might jack your Lexus, somebody tell these who Kanye West is, I walk through the valley of the shadow where death is, top floor, the view alone and leave you breathless, try to catch it, it's kinda hard getting choked by the Texas, yeah, and I check the method, they be asking us questions, harassing.
Well, jazz has been called America's homegrown music, but hip-hop has had an astonishing 15-year run, burrowing its way deeper and deeper into our country's pop culture. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck. We're taking a little survey this hour of the state of the music world. And Eric Arnold from San Francisco's East Bay Express is on the phone with us to help us find out what the state of hip-hop is these days. Eric, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you very much.
Now, a lot of people are saying, or at least some people are saying, that hip-hop seems to have reached a point of stagnation creatively. Has hip-hop gotten too big, too commercialized?
Yes and no. I mean, it's definitely no longer the underground music that it was when it began. And I have to correct something that you said in your opening line. Hip-hop is actually just celebrating its 25th anniversary. Not as 15th. So it's actually been around since the late 70s as a recorded music form.
But as a kind of preeminent position in our culture, I think 15 years seems more. I mean, as you say, for the first maybe decade, it was an underground form for the most part.
Right, right. I would say that it really broke through the mainstream in the late 90s when it started, getting, to number one on the charts, with just increased frequency and regularity.
Okay. So, but looking at it now, at the beginning of 2006, what is the state of hip-hop?
The state of hip-hop. Well, hip-hop is, at this point, it's everything that you want it to be. I mean, it's become a part of the fabric of American popular culture. It's changed the way we dress, the way we talk, the way we look, the way we relate. It's really affected people, that don't even listen to rap, who have no idea what a turntablist is. And at the same time, it still continues to exist on an underground level. But I think you could also say that the culture has changed considerably from back in the days when it started out.
So beyond music, then, I mean, look at 50 Cent, and you've got a movie, a book, a drink, a video game.
Right, right, so, right. Well, 50 Cent is obviously he's kind of like the poster boy for commercial overkill in hip hop, and he's also kind of like the flashpoint for people that are completely outside of the culture, that really don't know what they're talking about in terms of rap or hip hop music or MCs or rappers. They would say, "Oh, well, maybe drop 50's name to appear hip and contemporary," but they may not know that there, are 1,000 MCs on the planet Earth that are actually better at rapping than 50.
All right, we're speaking with Eric Arnold. He writes about hip-hop for the East Bay Express, a weekly in the Bay Area. You've alluded a couple of times to the fact that hip-hop began as an underground phenomenon, and you mentioned a moment ago that there still is underground rap. Where?
Oh, most definitely.
Where would you find that?
Where would you find that?
Yeah, give us some of the thriving scenes that are currently going on.
Well, I think right now you find thriving scenes in just about every metropolitan area, every places where the conditions that created hip-hop, and it's the same conditions that created hip-hop in the early 70s in the Bronx, they exist all over the country. And probably the most current example of that would be the Houston scene, which has been bubbling for years, and it just kind of hit critical mass this year with artists like Slim Thug and Paul Wall, and it's just really kind of blowing up. But you can also find regional scenes everywhere from Minnesota to Florida to Portland to the Bay Area to Atlanta.
What about New Orleans, where there was really a very distinctive hip-hop scene a few years ago?
Yeah, well, I mean, New Orleans obviously is still very viable. It's definitely, you know, done its thing as far as being put on the map. And I think it was really interesting the response of Southern artists and Louisiana-based, New Orleans-based artists to Hip Hop Katrina. They kind of stepped in where FEMA faltered.
Hmm. You mean, are you talking about people like David Banner?
Yeah, people like David Banner and Master P. I mean, these guys, like, personally delivered food and clothing to victims of Katrina. I think Master P bought a whole bunch of prepaid cell phones and handed them out, and this is at a time when the government was just dragging its feet.
And do you think that sort of thing will have an effect on hip-hop itself, on the music?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, we're talking about guys that, you know, aren't necessarily known for being socially aware, socially conscious, or politically active, who are seeing what's going on in their communities and in the world around them and are saying, hey, I've got to get up, get into it, and get involved.
So aside from Kanye West's very famous and notorious, you know, kind of comment about Bush not liking black people, you think there's something, you know, that some of these guys actually did something that was constructive and that will kind of point hip-hop perhaps in a new direction?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's. I don't want to quite say that it's a new direction for hip-hop, because hip-hop has always had, you know, in addition to being party music and entertainment, it's always kind of had a level of social commentary and political activism. But I think that we're starting to see that activism come from unexpected sources that we never expected to be politically aware before.
Yeah. All right, we've been speaking with Eric Arnold. He writes about hip-hop for the East Bay Express, a weekly in the Bay Area, taking a quick survey of the state of hip-hop. Eric, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, you're welcome.
This is Soundcheck.
Bush don't like black people. Bush don't like black people. Bush don't like black people. Hurricane came through the sub-round here. Government acting like it's bad luck down here. All I know is that you better bring some trucks round here. Wonder why I got my middle finger up round here. People lives on the line. You decline in the hell.
All right, we'll continue with our survey of the state of the music on Soundcheck. But if you'd like to email us, what do you think the state of the arts, the state of music is in the United States right now, you can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Okay, we've done rock, jazz, hip-hop. What about classical music? There are more than 1,800 orchestras around our country, from professional symphonies to college and youth orchestras. With so many, they represent a major piece of the performing arts world. Now, orchestras, like much of the classical music world, have been challenged in recent years. They're struggling to adapt to aging audiences and some tough economic realities. Joining us to give us the state of the symphony orchestra is Jesse Rosen. He's the Vice President and Chief Program Officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League, based here in New York. Jesse, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks, John. How are you?
Okay. How are things in the orchestral world? I mean, on the one hand, we hear about 9 orchestra bankruptcies in the last 5 years and 17 closings in the last 20 years. On the other hand, this glowing New York Times article recently about the L.A. Phil. Where is this? Is the orchestral world really on that spectrum?
Well, you know, I think, you know, every year a certain number of orchestras go through some financial distress. Given that we've got 1,800 of them, though, the numbers that are experiencing that is relatively small. And over time, what's happened is that almost all of them come back, and the universe of orchestras, the 1,800 or so, has stayed fairly constant. So when you net out the ones that go away and the ones that come back, I think it's remarkable that we still have 1,800 through this whole period of big transformation. And, you know, you referenced the story about the Los Angeles Philharmonic. To me, that exemplifies really the the best of what's happening all around the country now, which, as you say, orchestras are working to adapt to a very different set of circumstances. And I think one of the best and most interesting places that's happening is in the music itself. And if you think about the L.A. Phil's Tristan project, for me, that kind of says it all, because it speaks to the strength of the core repertoire, which continues, you know, decade after decade to inspire and excite audiences. And at the same time, we are seeing new music coming into the stream that I think in this period, more than let's say over the last 25 years, beginning to engage audiences.
So when you mentioned, Jesse, the Tristan project, this is Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, now a major motion picture,
right,
as they say. It's that opera, but with Bill Viola's video and direction by Peter Sellers.
Right.
So I guess what's interesting about that is, I mean, opera is multimedia to begin with when you think of it, but
right,
the addition of video and the whole kind of layering of additional meanings through the direction and the video, aiming at a generation of listeners who've grown up on music videos and things like that.
Exactly. And, you know, for me, the interesting thing about the Tristan project was it wasn't aimed per se. In other words, this was not part of an attempt to capture a market segment. It evolved out of the artistic sensibilities of an extraordinary music director who is very plugged into developments in other art forms and other media, and also the kind of pulse of Los Angeles. And so it emerges organically out of the music, and for me that's the strength of it. But, you know, you see manifestations of this all over. I was in Philadelphia at a concert about a month ago, regular subscription evening, and the concertmaster tunes the orchestra. Next thing that happens is Christoph Eschenbach walks out on stage holding in his right hand his baton and a microphone as though they were melded together. And to me, this was saying, this is the music director for today, someone who not only conducts but also communicates and speaks. And he began the concert by talking about Jennifer Higdon's new concerto for percussion and orchestra, which was followed by actually a greeting from the principal percussionist in the orchestra, who welcomed the audience, talked about the program, and invited the audience to come and meet the entire percussion section following the concert. So the whole event brought the audience in a way that we're not used to seeing, except maybe in a family concert or a kid's
right.
concert. But here was a regular subscription concert kind of opening itself up and breaking down some of the formality that has typified orchestras, and to a degree, I think, made it feel like a foreign experience for many people.
All right, now, you alluded before to L.A. Philharmonic having, you know, a very vibrant, active, relatively young conductor. That, of course, is Esa-Pekka Salonen. Is there, as you look across the classical music landscape, are we in general suffering from a lack of young and exciting and charismatic music directors?
I don't think so. In fact, I think of Esa-Pekka and Michael Tilson Thomas and David Zinman, Leonard Slatkin, to a degree David Robertson, a little bit younger, but they, kind of going back a generation, I think are now coming into their maturity as Americans who have grown up with the idea and what the role of a music director is, being distinctly American, very connected to composers, very connected to the pulse of the community, very interested in a broader definition of that role. And underneath them now, we're beginning to see a few others like that. I would say one of the standouts is Michael Christie, who's the new music director at the Phoenix Symphony. Michael began his tenure this September there, and at the opening subscription concert, he was in front of the concert hall welcoming each subscriber, saying how glad he was to meet them and welcoming them to the start of the new season. Michael also has a low-tech way of demystifying some of what goes on at concerts. You may have heard about the Concert Companion.
Yes, a little handheld device that with the screen, and it has kind of... Well, that actually is high-tech.
Well, that is, but what Michael does in Phoenix is he simply projects onto the back wall of the stage a number as the music is being played, and that number corresponds to part of the text in the program notes, so that as you are listening and seeing those numbers come up, they are keying you to places in the program notes so you can follow along. It's a very low-tech version of the Concert Companion,
okay.
But, you know, yet another way of bringing the audience in. Of course, Michael is also the new music director at the Brooklyn Philharmonic. He does intermission chats with guest artists from the stage.
But how much is this really helping? Because I mean, with all of these conductors who, you know, talk to the audience and try and do things like this, it still seems to be kind of a challenge. I mean, look at someone as eminent as Daniel Barenboim leaving the Chicago Symphony at the end of this season because he's tired of having to do the constant fundraising that comes with the music director job in this country.
Right. Well, I think it's going to take a long time. You know, I think that orchestras are definitely in a stage of transition and, you know, figuring out how this is all going to work, what are concerts going to look like, what will be the roles within the orchestras for developing programs and presenting them to the public. I think the music director role is definitely one in transition, and I think more and more orchestras are identifying a broader range of artistic decision-making and artistic delivery issues that have to be addressed, and to a degree they're looking to music directors with a wider skill set to fulfill those roles, but they're also admitting that just because you're a gifted conductor doesn't mean you're going to be good at all that other
right.
stuff. So Philadelphia, for example, has an animateur, which is a role that exists in England, and Philadelphia is the first American orchestra to have one, and that's a person whose job is to, it's almost, I think, the word mediation is used, not in the traditional sense, but mediates between the art and the public, and to think about all the ways the institution can effectively engage the public in deeper and better understanding of what they do.
So is this the person who would be responsible for the pre-concert cocktails and the speed dating Friday nights and, you know, having things available on downloading, ways of, as you say, delivering the music to an audience?
All of those roles, absolutely. In Philadelphia, for example, they have a name for that whole effort. It's called Raising the Invisible Curtain.
Mm.
And it's a concept that runs through virtually all public aspects of the orchestra.
Well, we've been speaking about the state of the American Orchestra with Jesse Rosen. He's Vice President and Chief Program Officer of the American Symphony Orchestra League. Jesse, nice talking with you again. Thanks for being with us today.
You too, John. Take care.
This is Soundcheck. Actually, Esa-Pekka Salonen, not just a conductor and a fundraiser, but the composer of this music as well. And up next, the big picture on the state of the music business. Are Americans listening to more music than ever? Stay with us.